BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Dialect Radio is back on the air for the autumn. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Filmmaker Elliot Bristow is with us in the studio to talk about his diary, Retro Road Trips, an account of his 500,000-mile trip around America that lasted from 1968 to 1982. Tony Gosling has a feature on police harassment of journalists, and Matt Heap is here with more of Matt's muses. There's an interview with Rob Hopkins from the Transition Towns Movement, who is in Bristol at the recent Schumacher Conference. And Jeff Sparks is back with us for this week for another edition of What's On. I'm John Peters Coleman, the presenter of this week's show, and I'm delighted to welcome Elliot Bristow into the studio. So tell me, back in 1968, you went away to America for a fortnight, I understand.
That was the original plan, yes.
But that went a little bit awry.
It went slightly awry, but in the end, in the best sense of the word, in as much that I was in New York initially as an arrival point, and this is a New York of 1968, which is quite a lot different to what New York is like today, so I understand. And I was mugged within 10 days. Complete, I mean, movie scene stuff, I mean, lying on the floor with handcuffs on and a gun in the nape of my neck. And the outcome of it, though, was that through a series of quite bizarre coincidences, the mugger was caught. And that led to me being prompted to be a witness for the grand jury, mm-hmm. which is, of course, as we all know, an American system. Yeah. But that led to me having to wait until that took place, and the tourist visa I had kept getting extended. So after a year, when the grand jury got convened, I just knew I had to stay, even if that meant becoming what was called then a wetback, or we would call an illegal alien. So I decided to stay.
So you caught the America bug. What was it about America that was
different from Bristol? Well, I had been primed pretty effectively, as a lot of other people had in that time. In 1958, obviously 10 years before, but it was still as potent, I read a book called On the Road by Jack Kerouac. It's got a certain resonance, and even as we speak, as it were, a film version is finally being made. Francis Ford Coppola has had the rights for many, many years.
Right.
And Walter Salles, the Motorcycle Diaries director, is directing it. And that's in production. I mean, that's a bit of an aside, but it does make the point that it's a film and a story that has a continuing resonance. And the resonance it had for me, as it did for many other, was the romance of the American road. And in those times, the 50s through the 60s, when life in Britain was, to be blunt, pretty grey and difficult, it had an enormous pull. And so that was my wish and expectation of what I might find in the States.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine that Britain at that time not having any major motorways at all, the idea of an American motorway would appear very different to you back then, certainly across vast stretches of when you may not see anybody at all.
Oh, absolutely. Even knowing that, the size of America when you're at least on the road level as opposed to flying over it, the size of America is still very hard to grasp.
So as a result of this, I'm now looking at a DVD that I'm looking at in my hand. It's Elliot Bristow's Retro Road Trips, 13 short films from when gas could be got for 33 cents a gallon. You've made these 13 short films from, I understand, how many hours of total video footage did you take on the road trip?
I have to give you a little bit of preamble to that. I had no real photographic background, but because in America, and it might still be the case, one reaction to it is that because we're all so familiar with it from films and all those sort of influences, that it's exactly like coming out of the movie theatre and finding the movie is still going on out in the street. So a natural instinct is to want to film it. And that was there for myself. And at the time, Super 8 film, which is now quite a specialist film, but at the time was just the equivalent of camcorders, was the natural way to shoot footage. And I should add to that that one of the other strands that moved my life in this direction is, as well as being mugged and staying on, I started working for a group of people who had a theatre down in East Village, right, as it was known, and who had really one of the first video reviews, literally ever. And it was a spoof of television skits. But you have to understand that in 1968, there was only 3 television channels, and this is in America even, and television closed down at night. And so anything like this was quite radical, quite revolutionary. The term they used in those days was underground. And I lucked into running their theatre for them down in the East Village, round the corner from Fillmore East, as a reference point. And after a year, the show got popular enough that they needed the show taken around the college circuit, the entertainment circuit in the States. And at that time, this even predates VHS cassettes. There was no such thing as that. There was even early, very early days of video. It was that far back. So if you wanted to show video, you had to physically turn up with the equipment to show it. So my luck was to be the person chosen to take these one-inch reel-to-reel video decks around the American college circuit and get paid to do it. So I went on the road, in the best sense of the word, that I had a direction and a motive and a purpose, and everything that I saw was just fascinating and wonderful, and so I kept shooting Super 8 as fast as I could.
So did you have any idea that you were going to turn this into a project that would be seen, or was it just for your own personal sort of home viewing when you got home? What was your attitude?
You're absolutely right. No idea that it would become a lifelong task. Just shooting home movies as one does. And yet, as these things slowly progress or change or whatever term you want to use, it became an obsessive task, to be put it mildly. And I finished up before I came back in 82 with a total of 75 hours of Super 8 film, which has been cut down to a usable 22 hours. Mm. But the process that you've just referred to was, no, it was very slow, and I moved towards that self-realization that I had a task of keeping a film diary. The expression I've started to use for it is to look at the present as if it were a memory, and that notion that what I was doing was going to slip away and needed a form of recording it, did slowly grow in its own fashion.
So when you came back in 1982, 14 years after you had left, not having any idea that you were going to be away for that long, what was Bristol like when you came back? You had your sort of 75 hours with the film footage. You'd arrived sort of back in Bristol. What were you going to do with the rest of your...
Well, that's a question I ask myself most mornings. But I think in this particular context, I came back. Obviously, my family is in Bristol. I am a Bristolian. Mm. And there was the very big question mark about what to do. And the form it took was just struggling, and I don't want to sound as if I am the only one, but just struggling to turn this diary into some form. And in those days, that had to be television. So there was a long 7-year struggle to raise the money to turn it into a television series called Road Dreams, which was 6 half-hours on Channel 4 back in the late 80s. And that really was the apogee of, in that sense, of public acceptance of what it was. And it did seem to strike a chord with quite a lot of people.
That must have taken an incredible amount of commitment and tenacity to what a television executive might call a glorified set of home videos, to try and persuade them, like, this is actually going to be a really good TV programme. I mean, it took you 7 years. I mean, what kept you going?
I think with a lot of people, the lack of any alternative. But you're quite right. It was only made by a series of, once again, of lucky accidents, and it's not something that the television world is particularly interested in. They see it just as that, as amateur footage. Luckily for me, in the best sense of having a response, the response to it was very positive, because it is not in the grandiose sense of a term, unlike anything else, but that sort of approach. You could call me a rank amateur or whatever, though I produced the entire series on my own. But a person from the outside accidentally being given full rein to produce the program series he wanted for television, broadcast quality television, was a real rarity. And a lot of people who watched it responded to it because of that factor.
So how did you... Were you doing that sort of from home then?
Yes, pretty much. That's how it's always been.
Right. And in those days, would have been sort of cutting and splicing and...
Oh, absolutely. One development of this, of course, is how the world has changed in the best possible way. The budget for Road Dreams was £150,000, and even as recently as 1989, you just couldn't make a film unless you got that sort of, at least for broadcast consumption, unless you got that sort of backing. And what that has led to, of course, is the notion that you can now operate on your own, in my case with Final Cut Pro, in a room and produce work of comparable technical quality. It's an absolute wonderful miracle.
Well, at that point, I'd like to play a track that features as a backdrop to one of these 13 short films on this DVD. It's a track by a guy called Rick Loveridge. I understand you composed, you commissioned the work, the music to be...
Absolutely, yes. It's original music commissioned for the programme. But I do want to say that Rick is just a stunning talent, and I feel considerably lucky to know him. He also lives in Gloucestershire, which is part of the Bristolian web.
Yeah. Okay, the track is called Snowbird Drive, which apparently is a slang term in America for Americans that are leaving the winter to go to Florida. Thank you. That was Snowbird Drive by Rick Loveridge. I read in the little booklet that came in the DVD that your grandfather was actually he went away to America himself and was on the Titanic.
Yes, sadly, and obviously in family context, and that does help in a strange way to thinking of his wish to change, his motives for going, was one of the things that gave me a sense of purpose for the diary, in the sense that when we talk about somebody like my grandfather going down on the Titanic, it gave me a frame of reference to the fact that people's efforts get swept away. And in my case, this business of recording the present, recording the world I was in, knowing that it would be swept away, his death was part of my background to that line of reasoning.
I mean, I must admit, I looked at that and thought, wouldn't that put you off, the fact that, he left and obviously never tragic made it. But I suppose, did you have in your mind what could have happened had he arrived, or what his life
Well, that's a theme that's taken up in quite a few films, isn't it? The what happens if this or that doesn't happen, and somebody's life changes dramatically because of that. But no, I didn't think about it too much in that sense. One is, after all, simply focusing on your own life most of the time, and that's what I was doing. And the other thing to stress is not forgetting that I was an illegal alien, a wetback. So American standards of living are quite high. So to survive, even frugally, takes quite a lot of effort. So a lot of the time it was just spent struggling to stay afloat. It's just that sort of world. But another comment about how times have changed is, in the late 60s, is that you could, partly because the economy was all stoked up because of the Vietnam War, but it was still a world where you could live comfortably enough on part-time incomes. And my understanding of what the world is like now is that's a lot harder to do. Mm. And also the sort of world where, when I first moved to LA in 76, I lived in an 8x5-foot garden shed for 13 months. And, that's not something that most people would volunteer to do, and it was certainly forced on me by financial necessity. But those sort of Jaffe Ryder, referring back to a Kerouac character, those sort of options, as extreme as they were really, I feel, and therefore I was quite lucky, it was much easier to live like that, which made living that way more possible, more likely, more possible.
I mean, you're still filming now. Do you feel that your kind of ability to live in the present is perhaps biased, or the way that you sort of behave is perhaps biased by the fact that you're always kind of looking at it from a cameraman's point of view, like thinking about what this will look like in the future, kind of looking back? Or,
well, it's a very good point, and there's a two-pronged answer to it. One is that I don't know if you've ever read Otto Rank. He's a psychologist he was a pupil of Freud's, and it was quite important in his time in the 20s. And of course, that's the whole point about artistic endeavour, is that it takes you out of the present, so you don't really live your life. I mean, that's a subject we won't go into now, obviously. But the other part of that is that the business of shooting film is that I now have so much footage that I don't shoot anymore, because I'm 67 and I have a limited amount of time left. I have a total of 22 hours of Road Dreams. I have another 25 hours of driving around Europe, and the time and effort that it takes to shape that up will probably absorb me for the rest of my life. So no, I don't shoot footage any longer, but I'm still obviously still involved with the task.
Yeah. So do you feel you're living life more in the present now than you were perhaps in the past when you were filming?
I think that's probably very true, inasmuch that a lot of things catch up with you when you get older. And I'm also a very lucky man to have lived like that, and I now have a lovely granddaughter. And as you get older, these things are really important. I was in my 40s and still sleeping in my car, and that can get quite wearing over the years. I'm rather glad I'm not living that life.
Do you look back constantly on these things and wish you were still travelling, or are you happier now, just as settled as you are, do you think?
I'm extremely happy to be settled. I'm extremely happy to be a Bristolian. I'm very happy with what the changes that are taking place in Bristol. And at the level that you live, generally speaking, you live a quieter life as you get older, I'm very happy to live it.
As a sort of a brief addendum, having experienced the grandeur of America, what do you make of our glorious half-a-billion-pound Cabot Circus shopping centre? Have you seen it at all?
Yes, I went down there with my wife, like most of us did, and like half the world did. And it's architecturally, I'm quite impressed with the sense that they've created a little miniature world out of something that wasn't there before. Mm. But the other side of that, of course, is it is just devoted to mad shopping. Mm. So you have to go with quite an ambivalent sense of what you want from it.
Bearing in mind Route 66 doesn't actually exist anymore, do you think that American road dream can still continue for people who are fascinated by America?
That's a very good point. I think so, but it has to be tailored to the awareness that the 70s, the 60s were a different time, mm. and the 40s were a different time, the 20s were. Every era has its own particular feel. And so I don't think that feel is about. Mm. It doesn't mean to say that if you're 18 or 19 or whatever age and you just want to be able to drift free and clear, as the romantic theme goes, that America isn't still a place to go to.
Well, as long as there are interesting people, there is an interesting trip to be had, I guess, certainly.
I think that's right. It's the people you meet.
OK, well, retroroadtrips.com is the web address to go to if you want to find out more about Elliot Bristow, and in particular his DVD, which looks very interesting, Retro Road Trips, 13 short films, culled from his 22 hours. That's www.retroroadtrips.com. And I'm sure if you put Elliot Bristow in Google, it will come up almost immediately. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing your life with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, thank you very much to Elliot Bristow there. I almost felt a little frustrated finishing that interview because I think there were lots and lots and lots of other questions that I would like to have asked him. I think we could have nattered for the entire hour of the show, but there are other things to look forward to. At political protests, police are increasingly targeting journalists rather than the protesters themselves. So this is our first feature from Tony Gosling. Here, Jeremy Deer, the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, talks to the Joint Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights on the 21st of October.
In relation to the issues our members face, there should be no difference because the guidelines on police and media are the same across the whole of the UK, whether it's ACPO or other, they have adopted the guidelines. What you find in practice, and I have letters here from 48 different forces, all saying something slightly different about how they would facilitate the media, how they would place arbitrary restrictions on different levels of covering protest. But I mean, I've got examples of physical attacks on journalists coming Brighton, Nottingham, Birmingham, Milton Keynes, obviously many in London because the vast majority of the big protests take place in London. There are examples of good practice in terms of policing of demonstrations, and they come about where the police in advance engage with the media, talk about the guidelines, use the guidelines as part of the training and pre-briefing of police officers so that they understand what is expected of them and the media understand what is expected of them on the day of a major protest. And unfortunately, that happens in a very few circumstances and it needs to happen in a lot more.
You say physical attacks on journalists, you mean by the police or the protesters?
I mean by both. A number of physical attacks, of which I have documented, some of which have resulted in court cases of journalists taking the police to court, whether it's being charged by police horses, whether it's, here's one from last week, this is a police officer having kicked a photographer, and this is the damage that was done to that photographer's leg. I've got a DVD, which I will supply copies to every member here, that has pictures of physical assaults by police officers on journalists, pushing them over, one of them being hospitalised as a result of being pushed off the pavement in Parliament Square outside. So, but also, because the police try to access the pictures and information that journalists have, that makes them more likely to become targets of the protesters as well, who fear that journalists and photographers may well become part of the state machinery in terms of providing information about protesters. So to be honest, when I say a third party here, I mean a third party here. We are trying to strike a balance between the police and protesters in order to ensure coverage of whether it's veal crates at Shoreham, whether it's the Olympic torch procession, whether it's protests at the NATO defence ministers. That's not for us to decide about the protest, but we have a legitimate right to cover it on behalf of citizens, and that's the right that's being infringed all too often now as these clashes between police and protesters become worse, and the serious and organised crime police has made that worse. That's the reality of the situation.
This question is just to Mr. Deer, because it's about the NUJ. I understand you recently wrote to the Home Secretary complaining about surveillance of journalists covering protests by the Metropolitan Police Forward Intelligence Team. Please could you give us some specific examples of where and when this has happened?
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole number of examples, and again, some of them are contained on this DVD. The police say that they don't routinely take photographs of legitimate journalists. How the police decide who's a legitimate journalist or not, they're all carrying press cards recognised by the Association of Chief Police Officers. But what they say, if journalists are photographed, or it's collateral damage was the rather the unfortunate word that they used. Now,
sorry, when did they use?
This is the police saying if they do accidentally take pictures of journalists who are caught up in a public order situation, it is collateral damage.
Is when you negotiate with them or discuss?
Yeah, we frequently have meetings with them to try to resolve these issues. Now, it's not collateral damage when the police follow a car full of photographers who they've already checked all their details to a local McDonald's several miles away from a protest site. As they're filing their stories on their laptops from that, the police are standing outside the window filming them on video. It's not collateral damage at City Hall in London, where they're standing an hour before a protest starts on their own chatting, and they're being filmed continually by the Forward Intelligence Team. So there are examples of this that we had serious concerns about. We wrote to Jackie Smith about it, and we asked kind of four very simple questions of her. Who's collecting the information? What use is it being put to? Who has access to it? And are they deliberately targeting journalists? We got a kind of unsatisfactory answer, and we're told that we'd get a meeting with Tony McNulty, which was due to happen this week, but of course he's been moved, and we are due to meet Vernon Coker now next week, I think it is, to talk about the issue.
We logged up.
Can I have a copy of the answer you've got?
I have a copy of it here. I can make that available to
full exchange of correspondence.
Yeah, no, I will make that available to the committee. But what we are seeing is a group of journalists who regularly cover protests being stopped and searched way away from the protest, being photographed, information recorded about what they're wearing, where they're going, who they're working for, and so on. And it is creating an intimidatory atmosphere that means people are less likely to go out and cover protests. And if we're all saying that publicity is one of the reasons for protest, actually what the police are doing here is undermining that freedom of the media and the ability of protesters to be able to get their message across via the media. So lots of different examples of it, and it has become an increasing part of what the Forward Intelligence Team are doing. Now, we're putting in some Data Protection Act requests around a number of journalists who regularly cover these kind of events, and we know have been filmed, and we've know that photographs and video exists of them, in order to try to find out some of the answers to the questions that aren't being answered. But one person has already done this, and they're a Sky News journalist, and they get back a file that says at the top of it, investigative journalists. Now, if this is collateral damage and these are deleted and it's accidental, why are files being held on investigative journalists? We don't know the answer to that, but we would like to know, because it is acting as an intimidation of those who investigate a whole range of different issues and who cover protests.
And these are files held by the...
This one actually came via via the Ministry of Defence and Metropolitan Police. So this is somebody who has covered protests that were happening at the DSEI, at the arms fairs and so on, who are then having files kept on them, despite the fact that they've committed no crime, they're carrying out their lawful business as a journalist, and the reasons for this are not clear, and nobody's answering that question, despite the fact we've been asking it for a long time.
That was the NUJ General Secretary, Jeremy Deer, talking to the Joint Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, and that was on the 21st of October. And the lady's voice in the middle, I should note, was Baroness Stern.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Late October. The shrouds of brown cover the ground, Mother Nature's party kegs. The rustling trees and autumn sound bury scarlet the final dregs of another season. It's the sweet corn and peas of autumn trees and hues of rouge that entice me, burgundy, amber and sand leaves, loose, tumbling and then free. Sunflowers bow their heads and wither like a grandmother. Yellow plum maples burn hands in the sun, destined to discover a warm felt reason to fall. Fox-coloured foliage embraces the scene, framed by delicate doilies, maple and sycamore, boomerang towards my feet, which means the spectrum of colours lasts no more.
That was Lisa Braden of Dialect Radio reading a poem called Autumn. Lisa is presenting her own new poetry show next week for BCFM, produced by the Bristol Radio Co-op. It's called Say It in Stanza, so keep an ear open for that one, and we'll have more details next week on how you can get involved.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that her dad was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have room with Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. Oh, what else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I just started somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see whatever common people see. Wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. She just smiled.
That was Common People by Pulp. And at that point, it's time for a humorous look at the week's events with Matthew Heap. It's Matt's Muses.
Thank you, John. The gap between rich and poor in the UK has decreased in a remarkable way since 2000. So says an international study released by the OECD, and that's a collection of 30 of the world's wealthiest countries involved in economic cooperation, for those of you who don't know. Between 2000 and 2005, of all the OECD countries, the UK was able to reduce its inequality of income gap the fastest. It needed to, mind, because even with those improvements, it still remains one of the worst OECD countries in terms of the gap between its richest and poorest. Since 2005, the rate at which the gap has reduced has plateaued and threatens to widen again if the recession deepens. There's a lot of inequality in the world. Inequality is at the heart of many of the world's problems. But what causes it? It's true to say that throughout history, a fair bit of inequality has been caused by one country exploiting another, stealing its resources, and in some cases, selling it back to the country of origin at a profit. This is how some countries end up weak and some end up strong. It happens at every level, of course, all the way down to kids in the playground. Richard Dawkins would have us believe this is the selfish gene in action. Darwin would say the strongest gene survives to evolve. But despite all the destruction humans have meted out on each other and on the environment, we still can't quite let the weakest amongst us fall away. Members of the OECD club spent more money on wealth distribution than ever before. Many of us give to charity on a personal level. This places us above merely being a selfish gene, I believe. Unless we're all just doing it in order to feel better about ourselves and alleviate our guilt. It is tempting for some to say that we are born into our inequalities, that they are decided by our genes. There are some that say nature also decides on a macro level, with some countries being blessed with natural resources and a fair climate. All of these things are true, but what lifts us above the selfish gene is our ability to readdress these inequalities of birth by our influence of that other great determining factor on human success, the environment. Whether we use our increasing knowledge of genetics to reduce inequality at a micro level is for another debate. Whatever your feelings about the causes of inequality, its effects are obvious. An obsession with the accumulation of material wealth as a way to happiness. So much so that the needy will kill in order to readdress the balance. Most crime is caused by actual or perceived inequality between the perpetrator and their victim. Crime is mostly theft. Of money, of life, dignity, happiness, food, energy, water, sanity, anything the perpetrator feels a need for and has decided the victim has got. When it happens between citizens, they are invariably caught and become recorded as part of the police crime statistics. When powerful companies or governments do the same thing, justice is less certain. For example, if I thought somebody on my street was running a dictatorship in his family, it would not give me the right to steal the fuel oil from his house or the petrol from his car as payment for liberating his family. But at a government level, it seems to work fine. When governments kill, it's called war. When individuals kill, it's called murder. One is legal, one is not. Depends who you are. They say a poor diet is a good indicator of poverty, but look at the countries with the biggest rate of heart attack, cardiovascular disease. They are often the richest. The Mediterranean diet is famously healthy, all that fish and dried fruit. Many of the people enjoying this diet are not wealthy. Eating organic vegetables in this country can be very cheap if you have an allotment and put in the time and effort required to maintain it. A nice story from Iran for a change. The authorities are worried about the high fat content of traditional food eaten there. They are promoting ostrich meat as a tasty, low fat, low cholesterol alternative. At the time of writing, a record-breaking attempt is being made to construct the world's largest sandwich, or longest shall I say, at a food festival in Tehran, using ostrich meat as one of its fillings. According to the UK ostrich farmers, all their meat is for export. No one in this country is interested in eating it. Is this true? Maybe you know of somewhere that sells it. If so, what does it taste like? Does it taste good? Watching the fat and salt content of what you eat is important, especially if you don't want to have a heart attack, and invite the possibility of someone straddling you and performing CPR to the soundtrack of Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. This song is being promoted by US medics because of its 103 beats per minute, which are very close to the ideal of 100 chest compressions per minute performed in CPR. Of course, it's not just diet that affects health, it's lifestyle as well. How much stress are you under? Places like Jamaica or Dubai lure us with their sunshine and perception of a more relaxed way of life, the perfect cure for us stress monkeys. Unless you've recently had a holiday in Jamaica, where they're stealing whole beaches from each other, which would prove to be a bit disconcerting, let's face it. You might want to blame the poor locals who can't afford the expensive construction materials, but live in a culture where it's normal to build their own homes. But according to recent reports, the scale of the removal of sand, about 500 truckloads, from a beach in the north of the island, points the finger directly at the hotel industry. The fact that this has happened in July, and no one has yet been arrested, has got some accusing the police and the government of corruption. They had to shift large amounts of sand to build the various palm islands in Dubai. That must have cost a bit, unless they nicked it. Unlikely, though, given the amount of oil money they have. But oil money can't buy everything, like a whale shark, for example, which is an endangered species. This didn't stop a new hotel recently opened in Dubai from getting in a boat and rescuing, inverted commas, one of the whale sharks because it was, in inverted commas, distress, and placing it in their swanky new aquarium to attract customers. Tell me, was the whale shark distressed before or after it got rescued, inverted commas? Apparently all the local primary schools and environmentalists are up in arms about it. The hotel have had this beautiful creature for 6 weeks in their aquarium and still refusing to say when they're going to release it back into the wild. Outrageous. All these exotic places are very well, but getting on a plane and reaching them will invariably create an environmental conditions that will destroy the thing that made them beautiful in the first place. So my suggestion to you is to stay at home if you can, and if you're one of the lucky ones living in the UK, you'll be treated in exceptional colours this autumn. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Matt. Well, who would have thought the Bee Gees contributed to saving lives? Judging by how it makes me feel having to listen to it, I would have thought entirely the opposite.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
David Lavery reading one of his poems, especially for Halloween.
Monster. Why is it that so often only children can see monsters and what they do? No one believes it if you say that a monster lives with you. We have vivid imaginations and bad dreams. We are too young to understand that things are not always what they seem. Is it only we who know where monster hides by day? Wearing a mask of smiles, distracting, whistling, deceiving, to keep the truth at bay. But in the night, no smiling, whistling now, monster is here, sullen, snorting sore of head and mind, cursing anything and everything said, critical or kind. Worse when in the company of demon, a spirit most dangerous out of the bottle. Selfish, roaring, stamping the ground in a morbid trance, scaring us to run and hide, pray we had chance. For hiding was all we had to protect us from the monster we called Dad.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Dialect reporter Anthea Page is at the recent Schumacher conference and brought us this report, an interview with Rob Hopkins from the Transition Towns movement.
My name's Rob Hopkins from the Transition Network.
In Totnes?
Yeah, in Devon, yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about your network?
Well, the network is designed to support and inspire and train all the different people around the UK and now around the world who are working with the transition approach and the transition model, which is basically a community-led response to peak oil and climate change, looking at how do we actually get through the next sort of 10, 15, 20 years of high oil prices, economic difficulties, in such a way that we can really see the potential to do something new and extraordinary within that time, rather than just throwing our hands up and thinking it's an enormous disaster.
Now, you told the room something quite extraordinary, that you print your own money.
One of the projects that we have in Totnes, and which is also now happening in Lewes in Sussex, is the idea of printing our own money. So, you know, at the moment we've seen in the last couple of weeks the danger really of what's happening on the global markets with money. And really all money is a piece of paper that I give you that you believe has value. You know, what we've seen actually over the last couple of weeks is that actually the money that we use normally, what's it backed with? It's backed with our belief that it actually has value. But the problem for communities now, when we're entering times of great economic difficulty, is that the money that we spend in our local shops has no loyalty to our community at all. So you could look at your town, your high street, as being like a big leaky bucket. This money comes in from different places. You go shopping in a supermarket, that money just pours out. At the end of the day, when they cash up, 80% of that money and all the potential it could have to make things happen, to create jobs, to create livelihoods in that town, are gone. They all just pour out through the holes. If you had money that couldn't, because if you took it 2 miles up the road, it had no value, all it can do is bounce around inside. So the way the Totnes pound works is that you swap sterling for Totnes pounds, you go and you spend them, so you still come back with £40 worth of shopping if you take 40 Totnes pounds to the shops. But what you leave behind you is, rather than a whole load of money just pouring out and going off to the banks to spend on whatever and to lose and to throw away like they are at the moment, you have money which is loyal to your community and which just bounces around inside. So Totnes was the first place to do it. We have now 80 businesses take it as being worth a pound. And in Lewes in Sussex, they launched their pound recently. They printed 10,000 notes and they sold them all in 2 days.
So who takes care of all the banknotes in Totnes? Do you have a banker?
We have an organisation called Totnes Currency who look after it. And we have a big safe box where we keep the Totnes
bands. And who makes it?
Well, we have the local printer print them on special paper. They're all numbered. They all look like a banknote. They feel like a banknote. They've all got like security features, and you can't just go home and run them off in the garage on the printer. You know, they're a very particular kind of a note. But what they do is they help us to tell a new story about money. What is money? What's our relationship to money? And, you know, we had a guy recently bought a pair of glasses in the local optician, paid £200 full in Totnes pounds. You know, it's an extraordinary thing, really.
And do you think the present fear of the credit crunch has made people want more Totnes pounds? Do they feel more secure in a funny
way? I think they do feel more secure, because actually, at the moment, money is something that's done to us by other people who we don't understand their motives and we're rather suspicious of. Whereas actually, if you have a currency which is issued locally, you know the people, you understand it, has the same value as national currency, there's something very important about that. And I would hope that, you know, within a couple of years we might see people doing that all over the country.
So why are there only two towns at the moment doing this?
Because it's still a very new idea. Because it actually does, it's not something that you can just sit down and think, right, on Monday I'm going to launch a currency. It's a big project, it takes a lot of planning.
How long has yours been going
for? Well, the Totnes pound's been going for about 14 months, probably.
Oh, that's not very long.
It's not very long, and the Lewes pound's been going for a month. So this is a new kind of thing, and we're learning all the time as we go along what's the best way to do these things.
Talk a bit about the growing vegetables in town centres. Is that something that Transition's hoping to bring back?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think people will be familiar with this term of food miles, you know, that when you buy a pot of yoghurt in the supermarket, it's travelled many thousands of miles before it gets to you, in terms of the strawberries came from Holland, the milk came from wherever, the tinfoil lids came from somewhere else. By the time you all add that up, there's like 1,500 miles in one single tub of yoghurt. And obviously from a climate perspective, just from a common sense perspective of all these lorries thundering up and down the motorways of Europe, bringing things backwards and forwards, it's ridiculous. So we kind of look more to this idea of food feet, and that actually what's going to be increasingly, as the price of oil rises, that what's going to make food affordable is the distance between where it's grown and where you live. And what we've seen in the last 40 years is a destruction of local markets, local agriculture, local farming, diversity. It's all been geared to export markets, all this kind of thing. And when we look around our urban landscapes, you know, whereas 40 years ago they were a mixture of allotments and orchards, market gardens, commercial gardens, all this kind of stuff, now we just have concrete, grass, paving slabs and trees that don't produce anything useful. So I argue really that actually having urban spaces which are just aesthetic, just to look at, is a luxury that we can't really afford anymore.
Could you just tell us now how to contact you on the website?
I run a website called transitionculture.org, or if people want to find out more about transition towns and transition cities, they look up transitionnetwork.org.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Jeff Sparks is here back with us this week for another edition of What's On.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, October 31st, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, First Degree Burns will be headlining with support from Vid Warren, and also DJs Ewan Who's Army and Asbo Disco will be performing. Now, there is a fancy dress theme, and it is going to be Dead Animals. Doors open at 8 p.m, and entry is £4 before 9 p.m, and £5 after 9 p.m. Also on October 31st, and at Hobbit's, which is at Colton Street, Weston-super-Mare, Goldblade will be performing with support from The Grit. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week the honours go to Goldblade. This group formed in 1995 in Manchester and to date have released 5 albums. This is from the latest album, Mutiny, which was released this year, and it's a track titled Wake Up, You're Already Dead.
Down in your bell, boy.
That was Goldblade with Wake Up, Wake Up, You're Already Dead from the latest album, Mutiny. For more information on them, you can check out www.goldblade.com. Moving on to Saturday 1st of November, and Bristol Radical History Group proudly present a night of cider, music and wonder at the Seven Stars next to the Fleece in Bristol. Performing will be Paul McCock, Who's Afeard and headliners Surfing Turnips. The gigs will start around 7:30 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 1st of November and at the Fiddlers in Bristol, the Zen Hussies will be performing with support from Los Albertos. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 2nd of November and at the Carlin Academy in Bristol, Airborne will be performing with support from Stone Gods. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. That is all from me tonight. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Hearing about first-degree burns, in particular in conjunction with you and Who's Army, and that's coming up, reminds me of our dialect radio days back in the Trinity Centre when we used to broadcast from there, because I saw first-degree burns playing live with you and Who's Army and a selection of his chums who all did their individual raps. And they do kind of like backing music, and they're very good at being sort of creative under pressure, should we say. They're really good and really tight, so I would have thought that would be very good. Don't forget the rally against climate change. We promoted this last week and we're promoting it again, so here's some more details for you.
My name is Kathleen. I'm with the Campaign Against Climate Change. This is a really important campaign, and we're bringing it all together Saturday, December 6th at Grosvenor Square in London. That's the same time when the United Nations is going to get together and have a gab fest about what we should do about climate change. And we want to show that we are upset. We want citizens to get out there and show that we want more than a gab fest. We want action. We want massive investment in renewable energy. We want energy efficiency. We want low carbon transport. And we want thousands of new green jobs. George Monbiot will be one of the speakers, and we want you to be one of the listeners and one of the marchers. So if you can come and join us at Grosvenor Square at noon, December 6th, and if you're interested in more information, go to www.campaigncc.org. That's the Campaign Against Climate Change. Thanks.
You've been listening to Dialect Radio, which comes to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op, recorded right here near Queen Square. Today's studio guest was Elliot Bristow. Thank you very much to him, and we could have talked for the whole hour, as I said. So we all wish him the very best of luck with his new features. The feature with Bill Nash was brought to us by Tony Gosling, and Matthew Heap read us his muse for the week. Reporters for Dialect Radio were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Lisa Braden wrote and read a poem, and as did David Lavery. And the What Song was presented by Jeff Sparks. Phyllis Tritch-Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Next week in the studio, our guests will be Monica Jones and Mark Hutton from St Vincent's Housing Learning and Guidance Programme, supporting people recovering from drug and alcohol addiction. If you want to volunteer, please do get in touch with us. Again, dialectradio.co.uk, we're always looking for people to volunteer. So it's goodbye from John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. Take care of yourselves. Goodbye.